This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we have stories about food in large quantities. From bulk buying groups and reasons for stocking up, to creative solutions for handling excess waste.
We have someone picking up our corks from the wine bottles, and they repurpose them to make buoys for boats and like shoes and all these different things.
Yeah, because of the COVID, everybody isolate at home. But to see the people face to face is still exciting. So we kind of treat it like a chance to say hello to the people and to the friend.
Listen to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection of food and grief, with your hosts, Zara Tangora and Bobby Conforto. Hi, everybody. How are you doing this week? Pleasure to have you with us, as always. I hope everyone's having a nice fall. It's such a kind of special time of year. It's funny, I just woke up not so long ago. I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, but I was feeling a little bit more sleepy than usual when I popped out of bed this morning, and I'm just realizing that we're not unlike bears, where I think the cooler weather in the fall is encouraging us to all kind of like hibernate. That's what it felt like to me, at least. So if you feel like a bear, you're not alone. This week on the show, we are joined by the lovely Laura Green. Laura is the founder of the Portland Grief House, Portland Grief House in Portland, Oregon. And the Grief House is this incredible place, and we kind of found each other on Instagram, and I was really interested in what she was doing. So Laura started this place, the Portland Grief House, and it's a kind of like a community center where folks who have experienced grief in all different kind of ways can come together and kind of intertwine and share stories and do different activities and art and gardening. And their motto is weaving loss into life, which I think is beautiful. But, you know, a lot of times, as we'll discuss in the episode, people who come together in this capacity to do groups and activities together in their grief are like separated into, widows and mothers who lost children. And that's really wonderful sometimes, because it is great to be able to, you know, share in people's specific grief. But at the Grief House, everybody who experiences grief kind of mingles together and shares together. And I think that's really interesting. So they have just launched a new website for the Portland Grief House, and it's griefhouse.org. Please check it out. Please follow everything that they do. And this conversation was so lovely. And I love, you know, everyone just has such a different way of like, you know, not only viewing the world, but then of like the vernacular they choose to express how they interpret things. And I really just liked the way that Laura communicated her feelings about life. I thought that she was very unique in that way. And the conversation was a delight. It was beautiful. So please enjoy our talk with Laura Green. Check out Portland Grief House at griefhouse.org. And stay cool out there. Hang in there. That's sounds like a generic bit of advice, but truly hang in there, because times are really weird and tough. And you know what? They're more intense and hot now, but they're always tough. You know, we always have cause to hang in there. So hang in there. And also please reach out to us if you would like to be a guest on the show, if you have a listener letter, if you have something you just kind of want to share. We'd love to hear from you. And thank you for your support. And if you do have a moment, please rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. It really does help us be able to access more people, for more people to be able to access us, which is the goal. And, you know, tell a friend. Hey, friend, I listened to this podcast that I like. That's a good old-fashioned way of sharing things. Okay, that's enough out of me. Thanks, guys, and we love you, and we'll talk to you later. Enjoy our conversation with Laura. So we are joined today by Laura Green. Laura, hello. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Hi, Laura.
Hey. Laura, you're joining us from Portland, Oregon. Do you say Oregon or Oregon as an Oregonian?
I say Oregon as an Oregonian.
Oregon. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. I also say Oregon, but I didn't know. Perhaps I was saying it incorrectly.
No,
but
for years I said Oregon because you would think, but no, Oregon, Oregon.
Right, you're not originally from Oregon or Oregon.
No, I'm not.
Where are you from originally?
Massachusetts.
Okay, awesome. And how long have you been out on the West Coast for?
We moved out here in 2007. So, however many years that equals.
Yeah,
a lot of them. Yeah, a lot of them.
So yeah. What are you cooking now? What have you been eating and cooking these past days, months, week? It can be, you know, yesterday or just kind of a general theme of the last, you know, couple months. What do you got going?
Well, interestingly, this last week, you know, because everything's on fire, it makes me feel nervous about heat sources.
Oh, interesting. Huh.
Yeah, and I don't need
that
to
makes
be.
A lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a requirement because I have my heat sources under control inside my house, but I still just like, I don't want to use space heaters. Like I'm just sort of like, I don't know. I'm just sort of disinclined toward heat. So I've been eating many cold things this past week, which I also feel, I mean, I felt torn because on the one hand, I feel a little bit, I mean, it's a little bit bleak if I'm going to be totally honest. It's, mm-hmm. You know, it's gray and, the animals look, I feel worried about like the crows, you know, and, everybody's dirty. And so there's part of me that wants to be eating like soups and I don't know what, like casseroles and,
like winter comfort.
Yeah, like thick, comforting things that are like, no, you're going to be like, it's fine. We're like, you'll eat this and you'll stay still. And in a little while, you'll be able to come out of the cave and everything will be better. Mm-hmm. But instead, I've been having like caprese salad, which doesn't really work exactly.
Well, it's comforting in a different way, right? And also, I mean, I guess just embracing. I think it's really interesting what you said, though, about feeling like you want to kind of try to avoid heat being that everything's on fire. And like, I don't know, it just struck me. I was in a very bad accident maybe like 14 years ago. I was in a bus that like went off a cliff and it exploded. Oh, yeah. And I felt myself having the same feelings afterwards of being very like uncomfortable, specifically around like grills and space heaters and stuff like that. I remember being at a restaurant and there was one of those like outside propane like space heaters. And I was very uncomfortable around it. And yeah, but not really like, what are the odds? It's not going to just blow up. But like when you're feeling like, you know, inflamed by something that's happened, it's like
a trauma. A trauma causes us to recoil in our body and it affects our digestion and everything.
Yeah, it's like interesting how our bodies, I mean, my body has identified danger, you know, it's like smoke. Like just on a really fundamental, I think, cellular level, a mammal body is like smoke is a sign that something bad is happening. And then it tries to figure out how to create safety. And I think that is where the challenge lies, you know, and even in this, like it's pretty, cause there's different, so many different paths to safety. So my body's like, well, on the one hand, we should eat thick, rich, like that's a path to safety. On the other hand, we should like only eat things that are wet, very, very wet is what we're looking for.
Which and would make sense with the conflict.
Yeah.
So you're in Portland, the city, or in the outlying areas?
I'm in the city, but Portland, have you ever been to Portland?
I've never been there as much. I have a very good friend there, but I've never been there.
It's lovely. It really is a delightful city. Most of the time, it's a really nice place to live. Portland is really neighborhoody. So I'm in Northeast Portland, and my neighborhood, so I'm in the city limits, but my neighborhood is like, I live in a house and I have a front yard and a backyard and like, you know, like a hammock and a hive of bees. And,
that's awesome.
Yeah. So I am in the city, but like the protests are, it's really been very interesting with all that's been going on in Portland, because people are like, you know, you're in the middle of this, like, well, I mean, with the fires, it's different. Oh, my cat's here.
Yeah. Oh, hi, cat.
Fine. I should have kept her out, but then.
What's her name?
Her name is June.
Hi, June.
There's June. Are you going to say hi, Junie? No, she's not going to say hi. She is going to say hi later. Sorry, that probably made noise.
No, it's okay.
She's loud. We'll keep our fingers crossed that she's not a major focus of this, that she doesn't, like, interject too much.
That's fine.
But they're all away. Like, there are helicopters that are flying, been flying over the neighborhood and protests, but you really have to go to them because of the way that neighborhoods are set up in Portland, which is also really kind of a strange, it's interesting, experiential thing. And then it's interesting metaphorically. And so
and the fires are the outside areas, right? Mm-hmm. From what I understand, they had a lot of fires in the outside areas of Portland.
Yeah. Yeah, there was one that was close, pretty close. It's still going.
Yeah. It's so scary. So, you know, I just think it's interesting. I live in New York City, and we've had instances in New York where we collectively kind of grieve as a city. I'm wondering what it's like, what's the beat like in Portland, just of how the city is maybe collectively grieving for what's been happening in all different ways. Like, you know, there's obviously been so much from the pandemic through to, you know, I don't think protests themselves are a reason to grieve, but the reasons for the protest obviously is a deep grief for a lot of folks. And, you know, like, I'm just wondering, like, how Portland is grieving as a community.
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I'm a person who, like, I think we talked about this before, like, I'm an only child of a single mother. Like, I grew up, really engaged in community. Well, I'm really, interested in the feelings of, like, the small group of people right around me. So, like, I do massage. And I have clients and they come and I have like really significant, really, like I've had clients who've come every week for 11 years, you know? So they're like people I know really, like really well and really deeply, but I've never been, as good at community in a bigger way. Like people are very engaged in, community and like I'm so into my neighborhood group, or like I really love this group of knitters, or and so I have felt like, for me personally, I felt like the way the grief has been showing up in Portland is like all these different groups of people are experiencing grief, like this is the way it feels to me. I mean, and of course everyone has it. But like individually, they're experiencing grief, and then they're experiencing grief collectively. And then for me, I feel like I'm then getting like different channels of it. It's like there are many lakes of grief, and they're all sort of slightly different in their constitution. And each and some people live inside the lakes, inside of this lake or inside of that lake. And I feel like for me personally, because of my work and because of just the way that I exist in the world, I have just many like tributaries, like many like rivulets that come through the spot where I am. So I have these like kind of experiences of the grief of different, like I have these little small experiences of all these different kinds of bigger griefs. And it's been interesting to see how many ways grief shows up in an individual and then shows up when individuals come together. Like the protests, I think, are expressions, right? The protests are expressions of grief.
Absolutely.
Portland has done this beautiful thing before and even during the protests with, probably New York has too, where people eat outside in Portland a lot anyway, mm-hmm. In restaurants. And like so many streets are closed and just have like picnic tables set up. And I feel like that is a beautiful expression of grief. It's like Portland Portland likes community. Portland is a city that likes that kind of bigger community that I have always felt unsure of or like a little bit foreign in. But Portland loves that and does it over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's working to figure out ways to make it despite obstacles. Like I kind of feel like that's what on some level that sort of feels like what the protests are. They're like, no, there are many, many things, but they feel like a community like insisting on itself.
Absolutely. Yeah. I felt very connected. And when I mentioned like the protests aren't grief, I meant like they're not a reason for us to feel like, oh, there's protests happening. We're grieving because that, like, as though they're a bad thing.
Expression.
But of course, when you said that they're an expression of grief, that's absolutely like couldn't be more accurate. And it's interesting to see just everything that's been happening in Portland in this way, because I don't know much about Portland. I know it as like a smaller kind of city, and yet there's been so much like activation, obviously, since the fires have been happening. It just seems like you guys have dealt with a lot. But it's interesting also how you're saying like seeing outdoor dining as kind of another like expression of like, because grief, right? Like we know it as just like this kind of like grief is sadness, right? Like something dies and you feel sad over it. But really it's also so much about like a rebirth and like opportunities for rebirth. And like, I think that being resourceful and finding new ways of connection and of like doing things that were once familiar, but in a new way, or is a part of grief too. And so I think like, you know, seeing how restaurants adapt and how community adapts to this kind of new world we live in is definitely emblematic of community and grief, for sure.
Yeah. A lot of healing going on.
So I just want to go back a little bit. You mentioned that you are an only child of a single mother, samesies, with me. And you had mentioned when we were chatting before that your mom almost passed away when you were very young, when you were like not even 1 year old, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So my mom is super interesting. Really, she's a very interesting person. She was in the convent. She was a Catholic nun for 20 years before she had me. She was a Marinole nun. And she left the convent. She joined when she was 17. She left when she was 37. And she left for a variety of reasons. But one of the biggest reasons was that she wanted to have a family. She wanted to have a child. Mm-hmm. And she had trouble. Like, she had an idea that she was going to have a husband and, like, you know, like a traditional, like, a, you know, the, I mean, that was, it was 1970. When she left the convent, it was 1973. So there was a, you know, an idea of what that looked like, but it didn't work out. It just didn't work out. So she just, you know, like made me anyway. And like, you know, she's like 2 years out of the convent. She's like, let's just throw a baby in here.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
And she was in California when she, my father and she met in California, and she got pregnant, and he was in Mexico visiting family, when she found out she was pregnant, and she left California and drove her Datsun across the country to Massachusetts, and raised me there. So I had aunts that she had two sisters that were there, who were a part of my upbringing, but she really didn't know anybody. And, she was really pretty on her own. And so we were living in an apartment and we had recently moved into it, and she didn't know the people in the upstairs apartment, and both of my aunts were out of town, and she was feeling very sick, and she went to the doctor and they said she had a kidney infection, and it wasn't getting any better. But she was so determined not to leave me with strangers that she just dealt with it. She was just like, mm-hmm. I guess it'll, I mean, she just was, she could not allow the possibility that she was like very sick. Mm-hmm. You know, because she was so fiercely resistant to the idea of leaving me. Wow. But her appendix had ruptured. Mm-hmm. And oh she gosh. Just sat in the apartment until my aunt got back from her vacation. And by the time she got to the hospital, she had like sepsis and, you know, when she lost an ovary and a fallopian tube, and she was in the hospital for like 3 weeks. And she was like, you know, you die, like you can die. People die pretty regularly, which I think is also a really interesting thing, how like it is possible to, in an effort to never, ever leave a thing, you know?
Exactly. She ended up having to leave for a month.
Yeah, and separate. You know, could potentially have ended up having to leave.
Exactly.
Forever, you know, or for whatever the space of time that exists after you die. Yeah, so, and I was little, but I think that I knew, you know.
Of course you do. Children that are toddlers and babies don't obviously experience loss in their thoughts, but they sense it. They sense the separation, and it's it can change your cells. You know, we know that trauma that happens even inter utero is felt by the baby in their cells.
Yeah. Mm.
So that was an early trauma that you had, and for your mom too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's the similarity. When I was, mom, how old was I when you were very sick? Bobby was very sick when I was like 6 years old.
Yeah.
Almost died.
Right.
And then also, you know, I was just kind of thinking not only about the sickness of like a single mother, but just, you know, we're going to get to it in a minute, the business that you've created or the community space that you've created. But I think that sometimes folks who grow up with parents who are, you know, single mothers, single fathers, I think, like, you know, in American culture, we're not as accustomed to the importance of community often as maybe other cultures are. You know, community can be a lot more not only important, but completely necessary in other cultures into like raising a child and to just the way of life. And we really don't do that so much here. But I think sometimes children of single parents, like, you know, rely on community more, and you're more like, I know we were enmeshed in community more in our family because Bobby was a single mom.
Yes,
because Bobby was a single mom who had to work, and we had to depend on, you know, not only like other people for childcare, but just for
friends,
relief, right? Like of like being just one-on-one.
For feeling like a family, actually.
Yeah,
because
right.
we had friends who are now in Portland. Family. Actually, the friends that were our community mostly now live in Portland, which is interesting. Oh. But they were a family that we just became part of because we needed a family. It was just the two of us. And at times that was just not enough. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the other thing with your mom being in the hospital for 3 weeks is that we develop attachment, you know, from the beginning of our birth. And it's a very significant part of who we are as people and our relationships in the future and how we see ourselves. So when there's an interruption in attachment, it's significant, and there's all different kinds of interruptions and attachments. A mom can be sick, or sometimes there can be addiction. Sometimes there can be all different reasons why there would be a separation. But so do you ever feel that as part of who you are, that attachment interruption that you had when you were young?
I do. And I think in a bunch of different ways. I think one thing is, and my mother is the best mother, you know, like, it's just so great to be loved by her. She's very good at it. And I think that actually made it in some ways, harder, you know, because she was there. And then she came back and she was like very much there again. But I knew that she could leave, you know, I knew that.
Yeah.
And I understood that she could die. Like and I don't know why. I don't know if that's because people talked about her dying while she was in, you know, like in front of me. People talk about stuff in front of little kids.
Right.
And just assume that they're not picking anything up.
But,
and I'm not mad about it. Like, I don't mind that I knew that she was, you know, it just made things different to be so deeply and sort of effortlessly and like very faithfully attached to her in so many ways. And then also so aware that she not just she could die, but that she would die, like she will die. And that's not a thing you can do anything about, you know, like you can't just eat cold, wet food and it'll, you know, like be all right. Like I tried all the things, like there's, I mean, and I think it sort of loops back. It's like, there are dangers that are so big and our bodies or my body, when my body becomes aware of them, it wants to do something. And sometimes there are little things you can do, you know, like, she smokes, she still smokes. She smoked all my life. And I was so angry with her all my life for smoking because it was a little thing she could do. You know, it's like, I understand you're immortal. Yeah. Like, okay, that's the roll of the dice that we got. We're both mortal humans, but can you please not smoke a cigarette? Like, do you see how like we're in danger here? Like you have to, like you could help, you could limit the risk.
So do I hear you saying that you understood that there was mortality and that was one piece of it, but did you also feel separation anxiety? Is that what you're also saying that you...
It's so interesting because as a child, I was not afraid of like the things. Like I wasn't afraid to go to school. I wasn't afraid. I mean, my mom was home with me. She cleaned houses when I was very little and brought me with her. So I wasn't separated from her much at all until I started school. But then she worked and she worked, you know, she worked days until fifth grade, until I started fifth grade. And then she started working nights also. So I was on my own a lot. And that was fine. I felt fully confident and comfortable. I wasn't afraid of like, I wasn't afraid of any of the things. I had a strange kind of separation anxiety. Like sleeping was really hard. Like I was afraid of of entering into a state of separation, not
like being separated, but just like being vulnerable to it.
It was like the metaphysical, like I was afraid of, it's hard when it's not a specific thing, you know, like if your anxiety manifests as a particular thing, that's really hard. If you're like, well, I'm going to take this fear and I'm going to tell myself that it's a fear of cats and I'm going to avoid cats. And that's hard because then you have to live a life where you're struggling with with those parameters. It's also hard if it doesn't do that. And you're just like, no, I know that what I'm afraid of is like looming ephemeral, you know.
Totally.
The spectre of death.
As we know, the recognition of our mortality, which doesn't always happen to children. Most children don't have that recognition, but it's both a plus and a minus, right? It's a positive and a negative. It's a strength and a weakness.
Yeah.
So
I was going to say, I remember actually having the same feelings like after, you know, you were sick, mom. I remember realizing my mom could die and it made me so sad. And I actually still think about it. And I also was scared during the night too. Of nothing in particular, but for a long time. I mean, I didn't even like to sleep on my own until I was maybe like 12. I was like so afraid during the night of just anything. And I wasn't particularly fearful other than that either.
Yeah. You're right. It does feel like now it feels like a blessing. And now I'm glad, like I'm very grateful for my child self. She worked hard on this death thing. Like she had a rough go with it. And she couldn't get out. Like there was nothing that little girl could have done to escape it. But like, damn, I'm so glad it was her and not me. Like, I don't want to go back to that.
Yeah.
It was hard. It was really hard.
It's funny you say, I'm glad it was her and not me. It's you. It's a layer of you.
So do you have any memory, like what was eating like as a kid? Was your mom a cook? Did you guys cook together? What was the food vibe like in your house?
My mom was a nutritionist and she worked. Yeah, she worked. So when she was in the convent, the Marinol sent her to school, actually to Hunter, Hunter College in New York.
Oh, wow.
Right? Yeah. And the Marinals, they're a very liberal Catholic sect. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the word. I was like, cult? No, that's not it. Another word. What's the
it's
word?
It's close.
And so she they do a lot of sort of social reform stuff. And she was doing food education in Guatemala for a lot of the time she was in the convent. And trying to help indigenous communities create food, sustainable farming methods that would allow them to be less dependent on, you know, government resources mm-hmm. for food. So she was very connected to food, not politically because she's not political, but in this kind of how eating or not being able to eat changes how you get to be alive in the world. Mm-hmm. And she worked at WIC for all of my, until like, you know, six, mm-hmm. 7 years ago.
Wow.
Do you know WIC?
It's a, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a government food.
Yeah.
Program. Yeah.
Yeah. June.
Oh, kitty. So cute.
She likes to smell breath. She's really, she wants to, clients come and they sit at the table and she like will reach her little head up. She's like, can you please open your mouth? And like, she's also very interested in food. And she just wants to know, like, are you well nourished? What have you been? Like, what have
she's
you been
a kitty nutritionist.
Yeah, she'll be a good next interview. but so my mom is very interested, but she's not, but she'll just eat anything. Like my mother is like the kind of person, like she just survives. Like she just opens cans and eats the things. And so like she cared a lot about the nutritional value of the food that we ate. And she also started working two jobs. So like starting in fifth grade, I cooked dinner. So she would come home. Her jobs were not that far from our house. So she would come home between her first job and her second job, and I would cook dinner, and then she would eat it with me, and then she would go to her second job. So I think in our family, I feel like it wasn't, we never had, like I always have, I still have a idea about like the big bountiful, I don't know, like table outdoors, and there's like overflowing bowls and everyone's gathered, and there's, and we never had that. That just wasn't in the, it couldn't fit into the schedule. But I think that for us, I don't know, there was sort of like always a feeling of camaraderie with food. Like this food is making it possible for us to do things in the world and other people don't have it. Not celebratory in that like like movie about an Italian family celebratory way, yeah. You know, where like but celebratory in this very workman like way, you know, in this very like
food to live. Mm-hmm. No, we live for food, but then there's food to live. So it sounds like it was more that way.
It was more that way.
Yeah.
Mm. What kind of things would you cook as a fifth grade, as someone who was in fifth grade?
Yeah.
Well, I cooked, then I had a brief period. I stopped eating meat when I was really little. Like when I was two, I discovered that meat was animals and was just like horrified. Like I was like, you have to be kidding. Like,
yeah, that's a hard concept for a kid if we really think about it. We teach kids to like adore animals and think they're cute and they're the first thing that you do identify, right? You're like dog, cat, chicken, and then you're like, but you're also eating this, and then you're just like, what? It is a weird concept for a child, but I'm sorry.
Ow, woo!
Right. Yeah, so you discovered that meat was animal. That's difficult. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I figured out a lot of, there was a lot of stuff coming at me when I was little.
Yeah.
And so I stopped eating it, but then I started eating it again when I went to school because it was more important to have friends, and friends ate bologna.
Yeah.
And so in middle school, I was eating meat, and I stopped again when I was 14. So it was just like a little window. But I made beef stew. I remember getting like my mother would get. Well, it was like we would get the cheap food. I mean, we also didn't have money, so we'd get the cheap food, and we would get like these like cubed steaks. And I would I remember battering, like rolling them in flour, and I really liked how they felt, you know, like meat actually.
You got into the sensory parts of it.
It's like
meat
squishy.
Does feel good.
It does feel good. And then when you flour it, it's like silky and squishy, and I liked that a lot. And then I would fry it, and we would also get meat ends from the deli counter. Is that a thing that still happens? You can go and they'll just give you like the ends of like
I think
sandwich meat or whatever. But it's like thick, and then I would like cut it into strips, and I would make stir fries.
All right, that's so resourceful and awesome.
Yeah, I had things. I had things. Yeah. I knew
you had your repertoire. That's great. Yeah. That's so cool. Yeah. So yeah, I want to talk a little bit about what you do now. So you're a massage therapist, but you also run an amazing organization called the Portland Grief House. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I can tell you about it. It's brand new, so it's just starting. So it, I can tell you what it's like now, and then maybe, I mean, I feel like this is all part of what it's going to, like, it's just getting made, so it gets to be whatever it turns into. So my idea is, so I think we talked about how, so after that, after my fear of, like, terrible fear of growing up in this terrible fear of death, and I struggled and struggled with her very actively in, like, for a very long time, I finally managed to like get her to be quiet by ignoring her, like, which is I think what everyone else does. And it's, and I understood that that was not everyone else, but I, for me, in my, the particular spot I was in the world, it appeared to me like a lot of other people were living a life where they were just ignoring death, and she was leaving them alone. And I thought that would work for me. You know, I was like, I'll take it. I can't get rid of you. And I couldn't understand how to get into that for a really long time. But finally I did. Finally I somehow managed to just ignore her. Yeah. And that did work. That felt much better. And I did that from like all of my 20s. And
can I interrupt one second? When you say her, you mean your inner child who's scared of death?
I actually mean
or aware, not scared. Not scared. But, like, you meant death. So you meant her meaning death, the awareness of mortality.
Now I have, at this juncture, I have like, I mean, you know, it's all just strategies, right? It's all just a brain being like, how can I deal with like concepts that are much bigger than my little neurons are? But at this point, for me, it feels helpful to have, like, I think about death as like a person. She looks a little, or not a person. She looks a little. She looks a little bit like a deer, like a cross between a deer and a bird in my head. When I think about her, but
it's good to have an image.
But so I was like, okay, you'll stay in your corner. I'll stay in my corner. I can construct a life. I just won't go in your area. Like, that's fine. There's a lot of space. And then my Aunt Ruth died. She was one of the aunts in Massachusetts my mom raised me. She was my primary, like, when you were talking about your family, she was like our family. And that was hard, and stuff fell apart, but I like dragged it all back together, and got back up on the horse, on the ignoring horse. And then in 2016, it just, like, we talked about this, like, there was just suddenly a period where it was like my Aunt Norma died, that other aunt from Massachusetts. And then things kept dying and leaving. Like, I could not get my feet under me. It was like, sometimes, you know, like death and near death and animal death and, you know, like, break up. It was just like everything was going. And I had to come up with a different strategy. Like, I just like had to come up with a different strategy, and there was no option except for just looking at her. Like, she was like, yeah, no, I'm like, it's done now. The like ignoring phase is over. We're gonna get to know each other, because I'm like everywhere. You know, she was just like, I couldn't turn around without it being right there.
It's like the archetype. It's the archetype that's always there, and you couldn't duck and hide anymore. It was better to just, if she was coming towards you, you might as well get to know her.
And it was, it was actually, but then by then I was, 35 and, or no, I guess I was almost 40. How old was I? Yeah, I was coming close to 40. And, and I was old, I was older. Like it's easier. It's different. And I found that there was a, like, not running was for me so much better. I couldn't have done it before, and I don't think it's the right choice for everybody, but for me at that point, it was just so much better. It was just so much better to just be still and know it. Like be in grief. Just like for me it felt like like the grief itself felt huge, and it still does, and scary sometimes, and like and at times like more than I can handle, but it's better than trying to avoid it, than running away from it. And it's beautiful, and it has its own pauses, and it has its own joy, and it has its own way of replenishing. And I felt lonely in that. Like I didn't have, like I suddenly wanted a community, like I felt like a solo knitter who was like, why can't we knit in a circle? Like, can we all agree? Totally. Like, who wants to do this with me? But it's hard to ask, it's hard to like call up your friend and be like, hey, do you want to like look at death and experience grief profoundly and in all things?
It totally is. And it's interesting what you're saying. I can really connect with that. And I think I've said this before on the show, maybe a couple of times now, but I think that there is the expectation beyond just like the inclination. I think it's almost like a cultural expectation to run away from grief and to recover from it as quickly as possible. And we do anything we can. And there is an advantage to, quote, recovery. Of course, you don't want to be consumed by it and allow the rest of your life to, whatever, you can and you can't, but optimally you will at some point find your way back to some kind of peace or homeostasis. But I think it really is so important what you can learn from those times when you are in really deep pain and deep grief, and to take a beat, like to take a minute to see what you see there, because like those are the things that when you do resurface in some capacity or some way, to whatever extent that might be, like the things you learn when you're in deep grief and deep pain are things you can utilize so much as, part and incorporate into the rest of your life. And we like we blow right past that so often, and we don't
feel better.
We don't organize around it in community to be like, hey, like how are you using this time? Mm-hmm. What's going on here? So, I mean, I think that's like an amazing thing that you said. And is that what promoted you in some way to start the Portland Grief House?
Yeah, yes, exactly that, right? Like, it's fertile and we're missing it. Like the image that I have is like it's like we're taking all of our, like if grief were the, I have this idea of how grief can compost itself and turn into like this soil that you can grow from, but instead we're like taking all our stuff and like all of our grief and like wrapping it in plastic bags and like putting it in the alley. And the alley is like horrific, It's not just that the alley is horrific and also like filling up. It's also, it's that's too bad, but also too bad is that we're not spreading it in the garden because it actually could decompose and make the stuff, right? And so I just felt like, but what I wanted was just life, like regular life that included grief. Like I had a great therapist, such a good therapist. I love my therapist so much. And I had spaces where I could be fully in grief, where I could like, walk in and be like, and now the grief is occupying this whole space. But I didn't have spaces where I could just be, where I could be many, many things. And that was what my idea was for the house. And at first I, you know, it was pre-pandemic. So I imagined, my mother has this big house, like a very generous relative gave her some money a few years ago to put a down payment on a house because, you know, she didn't, only single parent, she hadn't saved money. And so she lives in this house. It's like a house and it's only like 15 minutes away. And it's, I thought, oh, we can use the space you're not using in your house and we can have physical gatherings. And, we can just do mundane stuff. Like we can, fix bikes or we can like pickle vegetables. I really wanted there to be a huge food component. We can garden, we can like, you know, we can sort out how to ferment stuff and we'll just do stuff, but we won't, but we'll all agree ahead of time to be all the things. So like allow all the things to move through us as they do. Not, we don't have to be manifesting grief in any kind of predictable, traditional way at any particular moment. It, you know, it can just be like, I just, you know, like we'll just be,
it's like not, it's like not pathologizing it, but it being an integrated part of our humanness. That's what you're saying.
Like, let's just be humans. Let's just be humans, but like all the way. And we'll just do it for a little bit. We'll just do it for like an hour, you know, and then we'll go back and we'll like be the other kind of human. That's like, I'm Pat. How are you at the grocery store? Like, I'm great, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, we're taught, I think, in some way, and this is, and no, I have a great admiration, and I think there's a huge importance, Mom, to, for instance, what you do as a psychotherapist and a grief and trauma specialist. But there is this thing, even about therapy, traditional therapy, where you're still going inside a closed room alone or even in a group. You know what I mean? It's in a kind of hidden building. It's enclosed and it's private. And I know that for a lot of people, it's important for it to be private. Everybody processes in a different way. But there is something that I think is so beautiful about kind of just even being outside fixing bikes or gardening, where it's like, this isn't something we need to hide inside of an office. And again, Mom, and that's in no way to...
Of course. Well, I have a good example. I was telling Zari, you know, 9/11, obviously we passed it last week. And for 4 years, I worked in a project in our community on Long Island, which was a family center for grieving people from 9/11. It was not a psychology center. It was not a place where people came for grief. It was a family center. And we had a kitchen. And we had projects. And we had trips. And we made things. And we talked about things. And because everyone was so traumatized at the time, they brought their families. So there were 100 people that all gathered together for 4 years. And it evolved into so many different combinations. So I noticed on your one of your things on your website that you talked about, we're not separating, you know, grieving spouses and somebody that lost their job. And we're not separating all that. Everybody's together just talking about the nature of loss. And that's what this center was like, because it wasn't just, you know, although we did have sometimes separate groups for people who lost their children and people who lost their spouses, but we brought them all together as families. And it was a whole different experience because they had to go back into their lives with this. They had to rebuild their lives. And I think that's the concept you're saying, Zara, that when you go in an office and it's hidden and it's private, you have to go back in your life. How do you integrate that? So it makes more sense, or it makes a lot of sense to also have the living grief, living with grief.
Yeah, it's really about bringing like anything else that that is part of our personhood and our humanity and like that makes up the fabric of who we are. I think having it exist in the open space is important. You know what I mean? Yes. And it's like coming out with it, just as like coming out in a lot of other ways is important. I think we don't think of grief so much as like coming out, but really it is kind of like that, because it is something. As with the other things, you know, that people are taught to keep to themselves, like
well, the shame element and the isolation element.
And so I think what you're doing is really exceptional and important. And I'd love to see more of that happen around, you know, the country and definitely in our own community. It's something to think about trying to do, because like being able to like live, you know, grief is part of like our truth, right? When you experience real grief, it becomes part of your truth and your personhood just as much as like anything else. And
it's integrated.
Being able to kind of live that and process it and deal with it in a very kind of human way rather than this kind of tight, buttoned up traditional way that we're taught as like the, mm-hmm. you know, the natural progression.
Well, it's not a disease, you know, it's a real right. part of life. And one of the things I always explain to people is that when they first have a loss, all they experience is just the grief. And eventually, the more you live and the more you live, I don't think the grief changes that much. I think that we learn to live with grief because grief is life. It's part of our life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think so. Yeah, I think that. Yeah, all of that, yeah. and it does feel like. I think you're right. It does feel like a thing that. I mean, it probably is already happening in a million different ways. Like that center that you're describing sounds like exactly like it, right? I think that it's intuitive to us. Like, I think that there, like when you were Zara, when you were saying how there used to be a time when we. We're dependent on it. We lived in community and we were dependent on the community. And the community knew us because it had to know us, or the community was more weak. Like if I hid my grief, well, first of all, you knew about my grief because it was yours. You know, like if my aunt died, that was your sister. And so it wasn't, of course you knew about my grief. But second of all, you had to know about my grief because you were dependent on me. And so you needed me not to hide it. Like you needed me... So many interesting metaphors. It's like you needed me to tell you when I was a little bit broken because that was how you knew how much weight you were going to carry that day, you know?
Absolutely.
And it made everyone more safe. And now I think that we think it makes us more safe to hide parts of ourselves from each other. And I think that worked or sort of worked for a while, and now it's falling apart in so many ways. You know, like so many ways it's falling apart now, which is scary and painful and hopeful. 'Cause maybe on the other side, maybe this is the lesson we learn. Like,
right.
You had a beautiful quote on your website, I guess it was. And your website is beautiful, by the way. I really liked it a lot.
And you have a new website coming out, which is, one's already so beautiful, so we can't imagine what the next is going to
be. But you said that maybe broken is the first step towards a different kind of whole, a more inclusive and integrated whole. And that was just beautiful. That said it so well. Because that's the truth, the opportunity in brokenness.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think it's something that we want to rush past and not look at. But like, you know, it's funny. It reminds me of when I was in Rome, maybe like 2 years ago, I went to the Sistine Chapel. Mm-hmm. And before you get to the Sistine Chapel, you've not been to Rome. Have you been to Rome, Laura? Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you go to the Sistine Chapel, it winds you through this like beautiful museum. There's incredible art everywhere, right? But like they're walking you through extremely quickly so you can get to the Sistine Chapel. And if you look around, there's like Dali sketches on the wall. There's Picasso's. There's all this like gorgeous, incredible art. Like, and you can get off the line that's moving rapidly towards the Sistine Chapel at any time and look around at these side galleries, but almost no one does. And I jumped off and looked at every side gallery because I was like, gosh, there's so much here. Like, we're on the way to what we think is, like, you know, the end of this trip, the, like, piece de resistance. But, like, I don't know. I mean, we're just bypassing all this, like, incredible stuff. And, like, how many times are you going to go even – be here. This is it. You know what I mean?
It's the journey, not the destination.
Right. So like stop off and check out what's going on. I also think one thing that really struck me about what you were talking about wanting to do at Grief House as being really important is, you know, integrating different types of grief together. So people who are experiencing what you call big grief and little grief. And Mom, I know you talk about this a lot too. Of folks experiencing all kinds of griefs, maybe like what we consider, quote, little grief, like the loss of a job or the loss of a pet, compared to like the loss of a parent or a child or a spouse or something, and about kind of taking maybe the judgment or comparison out of that. And
absolutely.
Mom, like, what is your, I actually wanted to ask you, like, your professional opinion about, because I know you see all kinds of folks who experience all different kinds of grief, and I'm sure some people compare them, and then I'm sure in your own, you know, I know I compare when I'm talking about a problem to my therapist. I'm like, oh, but it's not like you know, I just lost my job in this pandemic. It's not like when I lost my dad, or it's not like what some other people might be. You know, we have this constant desire to compare.
Well, I think that I have come to, because of so many different kinds of losses in my experience, to not, there is no hierarchy. And so somebody could have just been disappointed about something, a job they didn't get or whatever. And for them at that moment, it's huge. So I really have learned myself not to prioritize, but I do see how people do that. And it's an amazing phenomenon, really. And so it's, we need to break that spell. We just really do.
Yeah.
Because what a person is experiencing, we had a guest last week, as a matter of fact, that had lost everything in a fire. And everything that she said had to do, it could have been the same issues applied to the loss of a child or a parent or anything. It was all the stages of grief, all the aspects of grief. It was really, right, Sarah? It was really amazing to see.
And I think when we're talking, when you, it just struck me when you were saying that, that like, you know, I think it's important to realize that what it all kind of boils down to, in my opinion at least, is that it's disappointment. It's like, yes, I thought my life was going to feel this one way, and it's not feeling that way. And it's like feeling your own mortality. I mean, like, whether people realize it or not, it's like, I will die someday, and this part of me will have never been satisfied, or I lost this thing I didn't want to lose. And it really hurts no matter what it is. And like, I feel like we can unify in that. Like, has that been your experience with, and is that what you're looking to do a little bit with the project?
Yeah, yes. I think that it does feel to me like when we, that we do it out of a good intentions, you know, like when I'm like, oh, but I'm just, all that happened to me is, you know, my cat died. So that's, I mean, I know that your grief is so much, you know, on one level, I think that our idea is that that is going to make it so that other people feel seen and respected, you know, like, and I think that's important. It is really important to figure out a way to not assume that you know what another person's feeling is, or to, like, I think that there's an effort that sits underneath the hierarchies, the segregation and the hierarchy, that is not a bad effort. That, like, I think there's an intention under it that is not bad and does
it's to honor. It's to honor.
Yeah. And that, then is it, what is it? Is it like, it also feels like there's a thing about it that's like, that maybe is acknowledging that it's easy to drown out someone else's grief with your grief. Like,
right.
Yes. Well, I have a wonderful story to tell that really fits this very well. I remember starting a group once, and it was a parents group, and they all had lost their parents and their children. And the first person described that her son had been sick for 30 years. He had muscular dystrophy. He had been, you know, so many times he almost died, and what an unbelievable journey it was for her. And the woman next to her, no one knew their stories, was glaring at her. And she looked at her and she spoke. She said, "My son died in an accident. He died suddenly. I didn't get to say goodbye over and over again. I didn't have that time." And they started fighting. And the other woman said, "But I had to go over all those years. He died. You at least it happened once and it was over." Right. And the whole group looked at each other, and we just sighed, and we realized, that's when we realized there's no comparing of loss. But, you know, we feel it inside of us, that the comparing, because it's the isolation. And that's why groups are so important, because in groups or centers, you get to experience other people. You get to feel their feelings, feel their pain. And we're used to being isolated with loss.
Yeah, and I think that I don't know how to do it. Like, I recognize that that is a thing that feels like we have a good solution for it, but I think that it's worth just sitting in the, like, falling into the discomfort again and again and again and again, like acknowledging that we don't have a good solution for it. Like, I don't know what it looks like. Like, I'm not under the I'm not deceived into believing that because we're fixing bikes, that stuff isn't going to show up, you know, like we're scared, you know, we're so scared. We're so scared. And I think that when we're hurt, it feels like I'm scared and I'm hurt. And now I'm acknowledging that I'm hurt and I don't have any idea. I cannot know for sure that it's going to be okay. and you're here in this room with me, and you're a stranger. Like, I think we don't spend enough time marveling, like truly marveling at the fact that we, like, I don't know you people at all. You run a radio show, like, and that is the full credentials that you have that make me feel comfortable, like, opening up my heart and telling you about these enormously vulnerable things. Like, I think about it all the time with massage. Like, I have a website. I have a website, and that makes people feel okay coming to my house, taking off their clothes and lying on a table and just, like, being like, do what you, like, go ahead, lady with the website. Like, you must be my friend. You definitely won't kill me. Like,
and, and your website says so.
Remarkable. Like, there's no other social animal that would even conceive of that. Like, imagine an ant walking into another ant colony and being like, let me lie down here and you just do whatever you want to me. Like,
listen, they might be doing that. We have no idea.
Well, I mean, I think science is trying to constantly determine, well, as people, we're trying to constantly determine what makes humans humans, right? Mm-hmm. So it used to be like our capacity to build until, you know, the Industrial Revolution and, you know, so on and so on. And now I really think it's almost been distilled on our capacity to really, like, feel, right?
Mm-hmm. And to understand, maybe it's the longing to be understood. You know, I noticed on your website, you had some books, and all the books were things that I love, every single one of them. Oh. And the poetry of Rumi and the poetry, you know, that poetry is 2,000 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's the same things that we talk about, this very, the longing to be understood.
Yeah, and to me, it feels like that is another one of the things that makes us, a thing that to me makes us marvelous is our ability to conceptualize, to believe that we're friends, even though, I mean, and I recognize that the breakdown in that is terrible, but the fact that it is even something that we could try to do, for me to imagine that you're my friend, like it is, I think from like a biological, like a, it's just amazing that that is a thing that any animal could do, that we could have an idea of there being, like, how many humans are there? Like, is it like, it's an 8 and then billions. So is it 80 or is it just 8? I don't know. I'm not that good. I'm like, it's 8 or 80.
I think it's billion. 8.
I can't think of a number that big, but we have some idea that, like, I mean, we can think of ourselves as Americans, and Americans, I mean, like, we can hold these enormous concepts and then have some idea of like unity and friendship in these like across these huge differences and in these enormous collectives. And I think that that's remarkable, and I think that it is not a thing. I'm going to use a word that is not the right word. I'm going to use a word that's a wrong word, and then we'll just see what happens.
Okay.
It's not natural. Like, it's not the thing that all animals do. We talk a lot about how humans are like these horrible animals and we like kill each other, but animals do that. That's what animals do, right? Animals group by type, and then they defend their territory from other animals that are like the same animals, like squirrels. People, I have a lot of feelings. I have close relationships with squirrels in my neighborhood. And people talk about like, oh, there's a squirrel in my attic and I'm going to be very humane and I'm going to live trap it. And then I'm going to release it into the woods where it can live happily with squirrels. Like, no, those squirrels in the woods will kill it. Like, squirrels are territorial. They're not going to be like, welcome, strange squirrel, come live in our woods. Like, absolutely not. They'll identify that squirrel as a stranger and murder that squirrel. But humans won't 100% of the time. Like, we will sometimes for sure.
Yeah.
But sometimes we won't. Like, a lot of times we won't. And that is amazing. That's an amazing thing. And I think that that's the most, to me, it feels like that's one of the most beautiful things about us. And, but we take it so lightly. We pay a lot of attention to the, I think we take it lightly, maybe. More lightly.
I think we do both. I think fear causes us to repel what we don't know, and love helps us to embrace or engage in what we don't know. Mm. And I think it's both. Unfortunately, there's a lot of fear in the world. There's so much fear with humans. Yeah, unfortunately, and that's the biggest problem.
So I just feel like I'd like to spend time thinking about, like, when we're doing this other thing, when we're doing this thing with our fear that's so remarkable, where we're suspending it and believing that we're friends, that we're, that we can have our default position be trust.
All right.
When we're doing that, we need to, I would like to, first of all, spend a moment marveling at it. Like, spend a moment being like, can you believe we're doing this? Like, this is awesome. Raccoons could never do this. And then I would like to, after we spend a moment marveling, just admit that it's really hard and that we're going to mess it up a lot and that we're going to just stay in that. Like, it's not going to feel perfect. It's just not, because it's not an easy thing. So that's kind of my idea for the house too, is that it's going to, that I'd like to create, and right now it's 100% virtual. but I just like to create a space that is diverse enough that you can, that people have the space to be, complex and imperfect and just stay around, you know, like stay around, like, do you know what I mean? Like, just
like, it sounds like it's a relationship house. You were describing relationship before, right?
The imperfections and the, you don't just bolt, but if it's not perfect, it's just a place to be. Beautiful. We can't wait to see how it develops. And, you know, it's just such a wonderful, wonderful thing. We always ask everybody at the end of the show kind of a similar question, and kind of just about like, what if you could give your former self, and as I mean, it's up to you which version of former self you want to kind of connect with. But I guess I kind of see it as the person, the girl you were describing, the younger person, who felt afraid of death, maybe, you know, and was kind of, you know, grappling with that. But if you could tell your former self, whatever version of that it is to you that you're picturing, and give yourself a piece of advice that, you know, knowing what you know now, having gone through a life, like, what would that be?
I think it would be, this is filling up all the space you can see right now, but there's so much more space around you, and you can't do anything about getting into that bigger space right now, but maybe know that it exists. Just know that it exists. And and that it's sort of and that it will come available. Maybe something like that. It's not very practical. Yeah. It's not practical advice. What would I tell her practically? Yeah. Tiny girl, you're so scared. God, I don't know. I think she did everything she could do. I just wish that she knew that that there was, even in that moment, not like that a good, that it would get better, but even in that moment, there was like so much more space around her.
So much
more space around her.
Perspective, right? Mom, you always talk about the cup of salt thing.
That I do, reminds actually. Me of that. Yeah, do good. Should I tell that little story now? It's a lovely Buddhist story about a cup of salt. So if you imagine that you have a glass of water and a cup of salt, and you pour the big cup of salt into the glass of water and you stir it around and you taste it, and it's so bitter. It is so hard to bear. But if you take the same cup of salt and you sprinkle it in the fresh water lake, you go out there and you sprinkle it, and then you take the glass of water and you taste it, it tastes good. The salt is there, but it's the space. So I think you're talking about there's a lot more space than we realize. And when we're afraid, it's a very narrow, narrow little space that we get stuck in.
It's concentrated. It's the cup. It's the salt. Yep. Everything is very salty.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, yeah. Intense. Right. Laura, this was such a beautiful talk. I wish we could talk for another 3 hours. But we should definitely keep the conversation going outside of the podcast, and we want to keep up with everything you're doing. And can you just tell everyone listening how we can follow along with what you're doing? Like, where can we find you?
So the website is griefhouse.org. And we have Instagram. I don't know about how social media works, but we have Instagram. It's the Portland Grief House. And we have a Facebook page as well. And I think you can find that also for just searching the Portland Grief House. And then on the website, there's also links to various social media.
Awesome.
Mm, wonderful. Well, many blessings to you and your mom and your community that you're growing.
Your beautiful community that you're cultivating. Yeah. And also just, you know, I don't know that I have the right words for this in terms of sending love or vibes or prayers. It all seems a little bit kind of not sufficient, but sending a lot of intention towards what's happening to you personally, and also just Portland and the West Coast as a community in this like really, really tumultuous, aggressive time in human history. So we're thinking about you all out there.
Thanks. It feels good to know that.
Yeah. Thank you. Good. Thank you so much, Laura. We'll talk to you.
Thanks, Laura.
Take care.
Yeah. Good. Bye. Thank you. Okay. Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.